Welcome to Wise and Nice, a true crime podcast with your hosts
Danny Armstrong
and Kelly Lee.
Please remember that we mean no disrespect to anyone mentioned in this episode or across any of the Wise and Nice platforms. We have an interest in true crime and related topics, and whilst we may offer our own personal views on certain items, it is meant to be educational and as light-hearted as possible. The information we present is collated from research gathered from the internet, and we reference and credit our sources wherever possible.
If you've liked what you've heard and want to join in with us, follow us on our socials, Instagram, Wives and Knives the Pod, Twitter, at Knives Wives, and Facebook, Wives and Knives Pod. We also have a little website where we post photographs and other information about the cases that we research. And this is wivesandknives.wixsite.com/my site.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Wives and Knives. We'll start with our usual little catch-up. Kel, how have you been?
Yeah, good, thank you. Not much to report. Working, still trying to get my house sorted, you know. But yeah, good really. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm fine. I've booked my belated honeymoon, which I'm so excited. It's about 6 months till go on the honeymoon now.
Oh, lovely.
And I cannot wait. I stress so much about booking it because it felt like such a big commitment.
You don't want to look like, you don't want to book something and it be crap though, do you?
Yeah, and regret it. And exactly. I have the the habit of just going back to the same place because I know it'll be nice. So I've veered away from that, but the amount of research I did wasn't healthy at all. I can tell you, maybe it's because I do so much true crime though, but I'm looking for where has a lot of pickpockets and stuff like that, crime rates in different areas and stuff like that. I'm ridiculously pedantic when it comes to research. Plus, it's a lot of money, and I think we've discussed things like this before, but booking a holiday to me is such a huge amount of money to spend on one thing. I get proper panics over it.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I think that's why I go to the same place generally, because I just don't want to waste my money and be let down.
Yeah.
So I'll go to the same place and guarantee to have a good time.
Yeah. Well, if anyone has been to Santorini and would like to tell me that I've made a good positive choice and it's amazing, please do. If you've been to Santorini and have any horror stories, please, for the love of God, keep them to yourselves. Thank you. I don't want to hear it.
I've never been to Santorini, but it looks absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
I mean,
in fact, the day after I booked it, I spent so long Googling to see if there's TV programs about it. So I've watched loads of TV programs, but my favourite one being Jane McDonald cruising, and she stopped off in Santorini and it was lovely. So I'm feeling better about it now, and I'm so excited. I've always wanted to go there, so yeah, really excited.
So when are you going? Are you going
end of August?
Lovely. Oh, it'll be glorious.
End of August for a week.
Please bring me a tacky fridge magnet back.
I will do, definitely.
I love the tackier the better.
Okay. I'll do my best for you.
Well,
probably.
You know, if you're having a quiet stroll around Santorini, you see a particularly tacky keyring, think of me.
I will do. I'll
amazing.
See if I can get you a little croc on a keyring that says Santorini on it.
No fucking crocs. Like, oh my God, no.
I don't know if we've spoken about this on the podcast, but I have two pairs of crocs. One are little flip-floppy sandal ones that probably don't look like what
they're
you're imagining.
Crocs.
And the others are your traditional Crocs. I've got them in black and I think they're dead comfy. I wouldn't wear them to a restaurant, I'm not insane, but I'll wear them to the shops and stuff, and I don't think anything of it. They're super comfy, there's nothing wrong with them.
No.
But Kelly is so against them.
I'm sorry,
she genuinely looks at me like I'm wearing a severed head on each foot when I wear
that. Would be preferable, it would look nicer. Probably wouldn't be as comfy.
Very
but
judgmental.
No, listen, I was here because I'm older. I'm old, full stop. But
back in my day, I saw crocs the first time.
That is literally, yeah, true. True story. They were not attractive then. And everybody clearly, you know, got it out of the system and resigned them to the annals of history. And then some stupid person has brought them back out again. And they're fucking horrific. The only time that you should be allowed to wear crocs, right, gardening.
Yeah.
By a pool, maybe.
Yeah.
And if you're working in theatres or some such, if you've got your scrubs on in the hospital and
I'm going to take my crocs to Santorini.
Good, leave them.
And I'm going to send you so many photos of like beautiful scenery with my croc foot in front of it.
There you go. No, I mean, let us know what you think about crocs, but I know who is on my side, and I really thought that when she said it, that you would listen, because I know how much you love her. But no, that wasn't enough. You were like, no, still going to wear him.
Kelly's on about Kiri Pritchard McLean. We went to see her, and she was amazing, obviously. I love her. But she said that she thought crocs were gross. And
she was right.
No, maybe, I think she just hasn't tried them. I think you need to put your foot in one to know.
No.
Anyway, that was a big digression. The summary is we're both fine. How are you? And let's get on with this week's case.
Yes, let's. I think we all know what's going on in the world at the moment. I think we just acknowledge that. It's an absolute shit show. And thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, it's very scary.
It's fucking terrifying, I'm not gonna lie. Like, we were having a little chat about it before, weren't we? And it's just horrific. Yeah,
it's like every time you put the news on, things are getting worse.
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid it. I'm trying to not to oversaturate myself with it, because I'm just finding it a bit much, to be honest.
Yeah, completely understandable.
Yeah,
but yeah, like you said, thoughts and prayers to anyone affected directly by what's going on at the moment.
Absolutely. This week we are in New Zealand.
Okay.
So New Zealand is famous for lots of things. I don't know if you know this. I'm gonna go through a little. Kiwi fruit.
Right, cool.
Sheep.
Yes.
Wine.
Okay.
Manuka honey.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Okay. But there you go. Every day is a school day. Rugby.
Yeah.
And Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Now, Peter Jackson, who directed Lord of the Rings, he actually also directed a lesser-known film called Heavenly Creatures back in 1994. It's a great film, and it stars Kate Winslet and Melanie Lynskey. Now, Melanie has recently starred in a series called Yellow Jackets, and it's available on Now TV. We're actually going to do a recommends episode next week, which, and I would probably have put this in there, to be fair, because it's really good. It's called Yellow Jackets, and she's absolutely amazing in this, as usual. So if you, like I say, if you haven't seen it, I would recommend it. But that's what made me think of this case, because Heavenly Creatures is based on a very famous murder case from 1954 called the Parker Hume murder, and that's what I'm going to cover today. So I'm going to start by talking about Pauline Parker. So Pauline Parker was born on the 26th of May 1938 to Herbert and Honora Riper, or Reaper. She was the second child, and they had another daughter called Wendy, and that's Pauline's older sister. And they'd actually had two other children. One had been placed in an institution due to disability, and the other had sadly died at birth. Now, at the age of five, Pauline was hospitalised with osteomyelitis, and that's a crippling, like, bone marrow infection.
Right.
And it can affect, like, the legs and the arms predominantly. So for years, Pauline underwent a lot of painful treatments for her condition. And whilst she did recover, it impacted her, like, physically. So she had, like, a slight limp and suffered with chronic leg pain throughout her youth. Pauline's family were working class, hardworking, and generally happy. So her father, Herbert, was a respected businessman and ran a reasonably successful wholesale fish business in Christchurch City. Honora, or Nora as she was known, was a housewife and mother to the two girls, and she was said to be a happy and loving wife. Now, Honora and Herbert weren't actually married, which was unusual for the time, and that's why Pauline is referred to as Pauline Parker. So her mum's name is Honora Mary Parker, just in case you were wondering.
Okay, I really like the name Honora.
It's nice, isn't it? Now, when Pauline was in her early teens, and so she's like 13, and attending the Christchurch Girls High School, she met Juliet Hume, and the two formed a friendship that would like massively impact both of their lives. Now, Juliet was 5 months younger than Pauline. She was born on the 28th of October 1938 in England, and her parents were called Henry and Hilda. So many like alliterations to names in this story. So Pauline Parker, her parents Henry and Honora, who had drinks with Henry and Hilda. Yeah. There's just so many. But just like Pauline, Juliet had too been hospitalised as a child. She had tuberculosis, TB. TB is a bacterial infection that can affect the lungs.
Yeah.
It's way more complicated than that. Like, there's lots of different kinds of TB, but I believe that Pauline's was pulmonary TB, so it did affect like her
as well.
Yeah, but it affected like her breathing and things like that. So one of the suggested medical treatments at this time for TB was a warm climate. And so Juliet had actually been sent to live in South Africa and the Caribbean in the hopes that the heat and like the ocean breeze would be beneficial to her health.
Imagine going to the doctors and then prescribing a warm climate.
Like, I know somebody who had SAD,
yeah,
or who has SAD, and that's what they were like, they were recommended that they should do. And I'm like, well, sure, if you're rolling in it,
yeah.
Oh, let's just go to the Caribbean for 3 weeks, darling. Like, I know somebody recently who has really bad arthritis,
yeah,
like crippling arthritis, and they went away for winter,
yeah,
to Spain, because the temperature is like more agreeable to the condition.
Yeah,
I'd literally love to be given 3 months in a hot climate on the NHS.
Like, yeah, that's what I was like,
taking your prescription instead of your like your airline ticket. Here we go. Here's my prescription.
Yeah,
book me on their flight.
That's only in. They used to prescribe seawater for a lot of stuff as well.
Yeah,
like, well before, oh, long, yeah, long time ago.
But drinking it, wasn't it, as well?
All sorts, yeah. Like, but people would be prescribed to go to like Blackpool and yeah, go to the sea and stuff.
Wow, amazing. Like, today TB can be treated really simply with antibiotics, and it's completely, yeah, it's not like
it's not the life-threatening disease, no, that it once was.
Of course. So yeah, Juliet's father, Dr. Henry Rainsford Hume, he applied for the position of rector at the University of Canterbury, New Zealand, because he thought it would be beneficial for Juliet's health. And her father, Henry, was actually a renowned physicist, partly responsible for the creation of the British H-bomb. So obviously he got the job and the family moved to the sunny climes of Christchurch. And you may have guessed it, but unlike Pauline's modest family and upbringing, Juliet was from a pretty comfortably upper middle class background.
Yeah.
But despite the different backgrounds and the home life, the two 13-year-olds quickly bonded over more than sort of their shared illnesses, which forced them to sit out like physical education. So they'd be the, you know, like, they, while the other girls would be doing all the exercises, they'd be sat together chatting and yeah, things like that. And both of the girls really enjoyed like reading, art, sculpture. I think Pauline in particular was supposed to be really good at sculpting. And they were like real, like, they loved fiction, so they began to write their own stories.
Okay.
yeah, I think that's really nice.
I'm imagining them like little Bronte sisters around a table.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, they began to write their own stories, spending hours, like, concocting characters, like, with entire narratives and everything. And they would actually write to one another in character. They renamed themselves Gina and Deborah. I don't know, say Deborah, but I know in the film it's Deborah, and it really annoys me how they say Deborah, Deborah. So yeah, but they renamed themselves as Gina and Deborah, and like further sort of creating and weaving this like alternate world, and like this different reality that they shared was called the Fourth World. And the girls believed that not only were they involved and actually experiencing it, they believed that they could access the Fourth World.
Okay.
So I think there's one moment when Juliet has a panic attack because of something that a pet like happens that her parents tell her, and her reaction to this is to go outside of herself and access this Fourth World. And in this Fourth World, both the girls would be there, and they would like know what was happening and things like that. And this separate dimension which they could access had its own like mythology, religion, its own like celestial beings. It was a whole different reality that they could both access together. And I think, like, I don't know, you tell me what your experience is of being a teenage girl and friendships, but I do know that girls can have extremely intense friendships.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And I think like these two are a prime example of that. Like, they were absolutely inseparable. So while both the families were initially pleased with the friendship,
I think it's almost like being in love.
Yeah,
it's very, I think that kind of intensity.
Definitely. I remember like a friendship from my youth, and like looking back now, I'd be like, oh my god, that's so toxic.
Yeah, like, it's really so intense. And
too
so
intense.
Yeah, so much like a romantic relationship.
Yeah, yeah, without the romance, but like the same level.
Yeah, absolutely. Same intensity, definitely.
So yeah, I get, like I say, both families are initially pleased with the friendship, but I can understand where that concern would also come from. Like you've just said, like, they were obsessed with each other. Now, Juliet was once again hospitalised with TB, and the family saw this as a perfect opportunity to like separate the girls a bit, have them spend some time apart. But by this point, the girls were so connected that they would actually become sort of like ill if they weren't allowed to
like
see each other.
For each other.
They'd become withdrawn and like physically ill. Like they'd have to take themselves to bed because they were separated. You know, so that I think that's where I'm aiming at. Like that's kind of toxic. I feel. But yeah, it didn't work. So their friendship resumed, and it resumed with that level of intensity once Juliet was discharged from hospital. Now, like I said, both sets of parents were concerned, but Pauline's parents in particular seemed to be more concerned. And it was their sort of concern was bedded in the codependence of their daughter's relationship with Juliet. But also, I think they were slightly worried that they might be having a homosexual relationship. So they take her to see a psychiatrist, and he confirms that he suspects that the pair of them are having a homosexual relationship. Now, the girl's sexuality is a massively recurring theme throughout this case. Like, homosexuality at the time was a criminal act in New Zealand.
Right.
So, you know, as well as being labelled like a serious mental illness. So, LGBTQ people could be treated for homosexuality in institutions like... And that wasn't just New Zealand, that was across the majority of countries.
It's so mad that their sexuality is seen as such an issue, when they're also inventing a whole other universe of, like, focus your concerns on that, darling.
Yeah. like
they're absolutely pick fine. You.
Yeah, exactly. So around this time that the parents were having concerns, Juliet and Pauline, who were still, you know, living and writing this separate reality, find out that Juliet's mum is having an affair with a lodger, and this guy's called Walter Perry. And Juliet's parents' marriage like breaks up because of this. And so the Humes decide that Juliet should leave New Zealand with her father, and they should go and stay with family in South Africa. Again, it would be good for her health, and it would probably help her through all the things that were happening with the divorce. But obviously, when Pauline and Juliet found out about that plan, they were really panicked. Like, yeah. They were not happy about it at all. And they even suggested to the parents that Pauline should accompany Juliet and move to, like, South Africa with them. But both sets of parents, like, flatly refused that. Now, Juliet and Pauline were, you know, growing extremely hysterical about the possibility of being separated against the wills, and they saw this sort of decision to keep them apart as like an act of war against them. Like, you know, how dare they try and separate us, you know, yeah. We're meant to be together. So the girls actually planned to go to South Africa together, and then the further plan was to then go to America to become world famous writers, where they'd sell these stories that they'd been writing. And they, you know, they thought that it'd be straightforward, get to America, sell stories, become rich and famous, and perhaps be actresses and things like that in America.
Yeah.
And they could live together, stay together, and just be friends, besties for the rest of their lives, happy days. But there was like one major problem with this plan, and they, which was their parents all together, but the girls focused on Honora. Like, for some reason it was only Honora that was the massive stopping thing for this plan.
Almost like if they could break her, everything else
exactly. So, on the afternoon of June 22nd, 1954, at approximately 3 p.m, Pauline and Juliet accompanied Honora on a walk through Victoria Park. Now, this was supposed to be like one of the last events or last times that they'd be allowed to go out together before Juliet moved. So it was a big deal, you know, and they all were super happy about going on this walk. So Juliet walks ahead, and once she's got around a bend in the track and she's out of sight, she scatters some like bright pebbles that she's collected on the floor, and then she like sort of moves on and hides further down the track, and she waits for the others to catch up. Now Pauline and Honora walk up the track, and then Pauline points out these pretty pebbles, and I think in particular it was like a shiny pink pebble. And she's like, oh, look, Mum, a beautiful stone. Like, that would get me.
Yeah.
And you can see it in your face. That. And I was thinking as I was like, yeah, I'd have been done here.
Yeah, Kelly would be on the floor getting those.
Like, oh, shiny. Oh, I can paint that. Yes, please. So Honora, Pauline asks Honora, oh, look at the pretty pebble. Pick it up for me, Mum. And she bends down to pick it up. But what she doesn't know is that behind her, Pauline has pulled a brick out of her coat pocket, and she's placed this brick in an old silk stocking. And I've read that, I was trying to think, what's the word? Like, what would you call that weapon? I heard it referred to as a slingshot, but I've put down she's made a swinging brick thing. Because yeah. But you know what I mean. Like, she's got, like, yeah, a heavy implement.
Put money in a sock, don't you?
Exactly.
Like, coins.
Yeah. There you go, from Danny's street fighting days. But anyway, so yeah, she's stood behind her mum and she has this brick, and she starts bludgeoning her mum with it. So she's smashing this brick onto her mum's head multiple times, and Honora collapses onto the floor. Now Juliet, who's been hiding out of sight, she runs the 60 yards to her friend, and exhausted because she's not, you know, particularly well, she kneels down next to the prone woman, and she takes the brick, and she takes her turn to beat Honora around the face and the head. Now, this poor woman suffered over 30 wounds. Like, reports vary between it being sort of 24 to 45 separate wounds, but they had beaten Honora Parker to death. Absolutely horrific. It's not like one hit and she's gone. This is a prolonged attack, like two teenage girls taking turns to absolutely bludgeon this woman to death. It's fucking horrific. So after finishing the deed, the girls ran to a nearby tea kiosk where they'd actually visited and eaten there with Honora probably about 10 minutes earlier, not long. And both of them were completely covered in blood. I read that their hands, their fingers were dripping with blood at this point. And they told the shop owner, Mrs. Agnes Ritchie, that Pauline's mother had fallen and hit her head. But they are so fucking amdram about it. Listen to this.
What, she fell and hit her head 30 odd times?
Exactly right. So this is Pauline. I've got some quotes here. So Pauline to Mrs. Agnes Ritchie: "We were coming back along the track. Mummy tripped on a plank and hit her head when she landed. She kept falling and her head kept banging and bumping as she fell." And then Julia adds, "I'll always remember her head banging." And then Pauline: "Don't make us go back down there." And I'm thinking, probably because she doesn't want to walk again, not because she gives a shit about what they've just done. So Mrs. Ritchie, obviously pretty shooketh, she rings her husband. And while she's doing that, the girls go to a sink to wash the blood off themselves. And Mrs. Ritchie is quoted as saying that she heard them laughing hysterically as they were cleaning off the blood off them. Mr. Ritchie, he goes and, checks what's happened, and the police are called, and the police and the ambulance arrive on the scene. And it doesn't take long for the girl's story to completely fall apart. Honora's body is so brutally beaten, and she has protective wounds across her hands, and it's completely inconsistent with the fall. So the police instantly knew who was responsible, and they knew the two teenagers had done it, and they quickly confessed to the crime. So 3 weeks later, a magistrate commits Pauline and Juliet for trial on charge of having murdered Honora. And the trial becomes an absolutely massive true crime sensation. It dominates headlines, and there were nightly news programs about it for months and months. Now, the defence wants to use an insanity plea, but that's hard because there are two defendants.
Yeah.
So somebody suggests using the folie à deux.
I was waiting for that.
But it's quickly proven that these two girls are completely sane and they are fit to stand trial. And that's I don't want to say it's a good thing, but if they were found guilty of the crime and being insane, then they would have been committed to a mental institution, and chances are they would have both been lobotomized.
Right.
So, yeah. Anyway. But like I said, they're proven to be completely sane, so that's, that doesn't happen. And it takes the jury under 2.5 hours to reach their verdict. And both Pauline and Juliet are found guilty of murder. And a 1954 news report noted that after the verdict was delivered, and I quote, "Parker looked across at Hume, whispered something, and they both smiled." So as minors, they were too young to be considered for the death penalty. And both of them were sent to prison, and they spent 5 years in prison before being released to live under new identities.
Oh my God.
Yeah. They were still under the watchful eye of, the New Zealand justice system.
I should
hope so. But both Parker and Hume, so both Pauline and Juliet, are still alive and living very quiet lives. For a time, both of them lived in Scotland, only 90 miles away from each other, but they never contacted each other. And there is, you will read if you do look into this case, like, it's said that they were, like, legally forbidden from speaking to each other, like they weren't allowed to converse. Yeah. But that's not true. There was no legal, like, stipend to say that they couldn't, but probably for the best.
Yeah.
They never contacted each other again. So after she was released, Pauline, who changed her name, she became a devout Roman Catholic and spent time running a riding school for children. She never, never really speaks about this. It's very rare that you get a quote from her, but her sister, actually, Wendy, she told a newspaper that Pauline committed the most terrible crime and has spent 40 years repaying it by keeping away from people and doing her own little thing. So she, like I said, she doesn't really do any interviews. She lives a very, I've heard it referred to as like a nun-like existence.
Right.
And there is a lot of regret. Like, there's a really good book, and I will put it in the sources, and it includes a lot of diary entries and things like that from the girls. And one of the entries is like after the event, but like just like pretty much straight after the event, and literally as soon as Pauline started hitting her mum, she was like, this is wrong, but it was too late at that point. It had to be completed. So you can make your own mind up about what you think about that. Juliet Hume, however, she converted to Mormonism and she spent time as a flight attendant and things like that. But she continued to write, and she actually is an extremely famous crime writer. Her name is Anne Perry. And she's become a renowned author of historical crime fiction. So her Thomas Pitt series has over 30 books to its name, and she has won numerous awards. So in 2017, she announced that she was moving from Scotland back to Hollywood in order to further promote like her books and hopefully get them like optioned for films and stuff. She has given quite a few public interviews, and she has commented on the murder, but she sort of still prefers to keep that part of her life in the past.
No wonder.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Do I think it's right that she, you know, manages to make money, possibly, from this? Not completely sold on that, to be honest. I feel like how Pauline has lived her life is possibly the
more
best.
Appropriate.
Yes,
almost.
More appropriate, let's go with that. Interesting little add-in though, neither of them, well, Pauline's more, is the quieter one, shall we say, but Juliet has confirmed that there was never any homosexuality attributed to their friendship. Yeah. Like, but how that is so focused on, you know, like, I think at one point they're referred to as dirty-minded little girls. You know, so, I mean, what do you think? Do you think it was a folie à deux? Do you think they're just two very bad girls who perhaps it wasn't great for them to be friends? Like, what's your thought on it?
I would lean towards the folie à deux kind of thing, but I don't think it has to be like a sexual relationship at all.
No.
Because folie à deux is, isn't it, madness of taking?
Yeah.
It's just, you hear about it with twins occasionally.
It's interesting you've just said that.
And
yeah.
That kind of bond and sort of the frenzied don't let the other one down, you egg each other on, come to this conclusion.
Yeah.
I don't find it obviously it happens, so it is believable, but I don't find the story unbelievable that these two girls that are somewhat marginalised because of their illnesses form this very intense relationship, and it becomes their, I think I said it last week or the week before last, but the it's us against the world mentality is never healthy.
Exactly.
And that's what I feel they cultivated, like, it's us against the world, look at all this, even though it was fictional, this world that we understand that they don't, they are the other and they are standing in our way. And I was going to say when you're younger, but even still, your problems, your own, seem huge compared to the grand scheme of the world, and nothing else matters as much as your own problems, especially when you're that age. Mm. And if you've got someone else mirroring that with you, it's not unbelievable for you to commit something that's absolutely absolutely horrific. And it feel like the only fucking option. Like, this, the, like, life cannot continue until we do this. This is the next logical, in air quotes, step.
Yeah.
So I don't find it so out of this world that that happened.
Because
I can see how it would. They were, like, very young. Not that that excuses it, but I think you do gain a little more perspective when you're older, or at least you hope you do.
Yeah.
But wow, the sort of how they have gone on to live quite different lives is very interesting. And like you said, I feel that Pauline's is somewhat more appropriate.
Yeah.
However, do I particularly condemn the sort of going on to be an author life? I don't know. I think 80% of me is like, she shouldn't be allowed to have such a obviously good life afterwards. But there is maybe 20% of me that thinks like, she's paid her dues in the eyes of the law, and she's just living the life that she wanted afterwards. And so, like,
I know, not
good for her, but
yeah, it's, I feel like it's 5 years.
Five years is absolutely ridiculous.
I know they were, you know, they were young, but still, 5 years is a bit of a fuck you to an aura, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not a lot. I think that it's interesting what you said about it happens a lot with twins. There is an excellent book, and the writer, he calls it, it's not, I think he refers to it as twin transference, but I think he's implying that it's that level, like you just said, basically, that was part, a big part of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very interesting case. There are lots of books, lots of other podcasts to listen to, which go into a lot more detail. I will put the links and the sources. If you do get a chance to, you know, give Heavenly Creatures a go, because they are, it is quite, I'd say it's a bit more of a sympathetic view on the case, because it there's so much focus on the alleged homosexual behaviour and how these girls were absolutely horrific. But like you said, were they just two marginalised teenagers who, you know, pulled together to get through something in their lives?
Amazing. That was super unexpected, because I didn't know anything about that case. Just the last thing that jumped to mind when you were telling me that, it's very similar to these Slender Man killings.
Yeah, it is.
Because that was teenage girls that had this, like, other reality in their head, where there was, like, they had to do something in order to be free, and they ended up stabbing their friend multiple times.
Yeah.
Like that kind of mentality.
Yeah, it is.
Similar.
Yeah, it is. It does remind me of that. I don't want to give them credit, but how impressive to also create a whole new, you know, like, reality. And if it happened now, they'd probably be like designing video games and shit like that.
Yeah.
Which probably would have been a better way to for the story to play out.
Oh, absolutely, Matt. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. Hope everyone's enjoyed it.
And next week is a recommends, like, true crime / crime related sort of TV, books, articles, even things like that.
Yeah.
And then the week after is my case.
Do you know what you're doing, or is it?
Yes.
Oh.
I told you the other week
slept since then, babe. Apologies.
Tamala.
Oh, is that? Ah, right. Yes. Yes. Tamala Horsford.
Yes, Horsford, yeah. Yeah,
very good.
That's
another very interesting case.
Oh, they're always very interesting.
Naturally.
Anyway, have a lovely week. Yeah. And we'll see you next week.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Awesome.